Seventh-day Adventist Bible Commentary on Exodus, Chapter 1, Verse 2. Egyptians sinned in refusing light. The sin of the Egyptians was that they had refused the light which God had so graciously sent to them through Joseph. Youth's Instructor, April 15, 1897. Chapter 2, Verse 10. Also, Hebrews chapter 11, verses 26 and 27. In Egypt, Moses studied laws of God. The strength of Moses was his connection with the source of all power, the Lord God of hosts. He rises grandly above every earthly inducement and trusts himself wholly to God. He considered that he was the Lord's. While he was connected with the official interests of the king of Egypt, he was constantly studying the laws of God's government, and thus his faith grew. That faith was of value to him. It was deeply rooted in the soil of his earliest teachings, and the culture of his life was to prepare him for the great work of delivering Israel from bondage. He meditated on these things. He was constantly listening to his commission from God. After slaying the Egyptian, he saw that he had not understood God's plan, and he fled from Egypt and became a shepherd. He was no longer planning to do a great work, but he became very humble. The mists that were beclouding his mind were expelled, and he disciplined his mind to seek after God as his refuge. Letter 21A, 1893. Verse 11, Acts 7:22, Training for Generalship. Moses was a man of intelligence. In the providence of God, he was given opportunity to gain a fitness for a great work. He was thoroughly educated as a general. When he went out to meet the enemy, he was successful, and on his return from battle, his praises were sung by the whole army. Notwithstanding this, he constantly remembered that through him, God purposed to deliver the children of Israel. Youth's Instructor, January 29, 1903. Chapter 3, Verse 1. Jethro singled out. Jethro was singled out from the darkness of the Gentile world to reveal the principles of heaven. God has ever had appointed agencies and has ever given abundant evidences that these agencies were heaven-appointed and heaven-sent. Letter 190, 1905. Moses transferred to a private school. God transferred Moses from the courts of luxury, where his every wish was gratified, to a more private school. Here the Lord would commune with Moses, and so educate him that he would obtain a knowledge of the hardships, trials, and perils of the wilderness. Youth's Instructor, December 13, 1900. Verses 2 to 5. Burning bush, a reality. It will baffle the keenest intellect to interpret the divine manifestation of the burning bush. It was not a dream. It was not a vision. It was a living reality, something that Moses saw with his eyes. He heard the voice of God calling to him out of the bush, and he covered his face, realizing that he stood in the immediate presence of God. God was conversing with humanity. Never could Moses describe the impression made upon his mind by the sight he then saw, and by the sound of the voice that spoke to him. But this impression was never effaced. Heaven came very near to him, as with reverent awe he listened to the words, "I am the God of thy father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." What wondrous condescension for God to leave the heavenly courts and manifest himself to Moses, talking with him face to face, as a man speaketh unto his friend. Ibid, December 20, 1900. Verse 14. God sees future as we see present. I am means an eternal presence. The past, present, and future are alike to God. He sees the most remote events of past history and the far distant future with as clear a vision as we do things that are transpiring daily. We know not what is before us, and if we did, it would not contribute to our eternal welfare. God gives us an opportunity to exercise faith and trust in the great I Am. Manuscript 5A, 1895. Verse 20. Plagues, a sign of God's power over all. When the children of Israel were in bondage to the Egyptians, God revealed himself as a God above all human authority, all human greatness. The signs and miracles he wrought in behalf of his people show his power over nature and over the greatest among those who worshiped nature, who ignored the power that made nature. God went through the proud land of Egypt just as he will go through the earth in the last days. Review and Herald, July 10, 1900.
Bible Commentary, comments on Exodus 4, verse 10. Fearful of bringing self into work. When, after Moses' time of preparation and trial was over, he was once more told to go and deliver Israel, he was self-distrustful, slow of speech, timid. "Who am I," he said, "that I should go unto Pharaoh, and that I should bring forth the children of Israel out of Egypt?" He pleaded as an excuse a lack of ready speech. He had been the general of the armies of Egypt, and he certainly knew how to speak, but he was afraid that he would bring self into his work. Manuscript 11, 1903. Verse 21. Rejection of light hardens heart. Pharaoh saw the mighty working of the Spirit of God. He saw the miracles which the Lord performed by his servant, but he refused obedience to God's command. The rebellious king had proudly inquired, "Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice to let Israel go?" Exodus 5:2. And as the judgments of God fell more and more heavily upon him, he persisted in stubborn resistance. By rejecting light from heaven, he became hard and unimpressible. The providence of God was revealing his power, and these manifestations, unacknowledged, were the means of hardening Pharaoh's heart against greater light. Those who exalt their own ideas above the plainly specified will of God are saying, as did Pharaoh, "Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice?" Every rejection of light hardens the heart and darkens the understanding, and thus men find it more and more difficult to distinguish between right and wrong, and they become bolder in resisting the will of God. Manuscript 3, 1885. God gave Pharaoh into hands of self. Every additional evidence of the power of God that the Egyptian monarch resisted carried him on a stronger and more persistent defiance of God. Thus the work went on, finite man warring against the express will of an infinite God. This case is a clear illustration of the sin against the Holy Ghost. Whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. Gradually the Lord withdrew his spirit. Removing his restraining power, he gave the king into the hands of the worst of all tyrants, self. Review and Herald, July 27, 1897. Pharaoh sowed obstinacy, reaped obstinacy. Whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. Pharaoh sowed obstinacy, and he reaped obstinacy. He himself put this seed into the soil. There was no more need for God by some new power to interfere with its growth than there is for him to interfere with the growth of a grain of corn. All that is required is that a seed shall be left to germinate and spring up to bring forth fruit after its kind. The harvest reveals the kind of seed that has been sown. Manuscript 126, 1901. Rebellion produces rebellion. After the plague was stayed, the king refused to let Israel go. Rebellion produces rebellion. The king had become so hardened with his continual opposition to the will of God that his whole being rose in rebellion to the awful exhibitions of his divine power. Spiritual Gifts, Volume 3, page 215. Israel would be preserved even if Pharaoh had to die. Pharaoh hardened his heart against the Lord, and he ventured, notwithstanding all the signs and mighty wonders he had witnessed, to threaten that if Moses and Aaron appeared before him again, they should die. If the king had not become hardened in his rebellion against God, he would have been humbled under a sense of the power of the living God who could save or destroy. He would have known that he who could do such miracles and multiply his signs and wonders would preserve the lives of his chosen servants, even if he should have to slay the king of Egypt. Spiritual Gifts, Volume 3, page 220, Chapter 7, verses 10 to 12. Magicians work a counterfeit. The magicians seem to perform several things with their enchantments similar to those things which God wrought by the hand of Moses and Aaron. They did not really cause their rods to become serpents, but by magic, aided by the great deceiver, made them appear like servants to counterfeit the work of God. Satan assisted his servants to resist the work of the Most High in order to deceive the people and encourage them in their rebellion. Pharaoh would grasp the least evidence he could obtain to justify himself in resisting the work of God performed by Moses and Aaron. He told these servants of God that his magicians could do all these wonders. The difference between the work of God and that of magicians was one was of God and the other of Satan. One was true and the other false. Spiritual Gifts, Volume 3, page 205 and 206. Chapter 8, verse 7. Pharaoh continued devotions during plagues. During the plagues on Egypt, Pharaoh was punctual in his superstitious devotion to the river and visited it every morning, and as he stood upon its banks, he offered praise and thanksgiving to the water, recounting the great good it accomplished and telling the water of its great power, that without it they could not exist, for their lands were watered by it and it supplied meat for their tables. Spiritual Gifts, Volume 4, pages 54 and 55. Chapter 9, verse 3. Effect of plagues tested. Those who regarded the word of the Lord gathered their cattle into barns and houses, while those whose hearts were hardened, like Pharaoh's, left their cattle in the field. Here was an opportunity to test the exalted pride of the Egyptians and to show the number whose hearts were really affected by the wonderful dealings of God with his people, whom they had despised and cruelly entreated. Spiritual Gifts, Volume 3, page 214. Chapter 11, verses 1 and 8. Moses fearlessly met Pharaoh again. Notwithstanding, Moses had been forbidden to come again into the presence of Pharaoh, for in the day he should see his face he should die, yet he had one more message from God to the rebellious king, and he firmly walked into his presence and stood fearlessly before him to declare to him the word of the Lord. As Moses told the king of the plague which would come upon them, more dreadful than any that had yet visited Egypt, which would cause all his great counselors to bow down before him and entreat the Israelites to leave Egypt, the king was exceedingly angry. He was enraged because he could not intimidate Moses and make him tremble before his kingly authority. But Moses leaned for support upon a mightier arm than that of any earthly monarch. Spiritual Gifts, Volume 3, pages 221, 222.
Chapter 12, verses 31 and 32.
Pharaoh brought from pride to humility. When the Egyptians, from the king upon his throne down to the lowliest servant, were afflicted, and their firstborn were slain, then there was wailing throughout all Egypt. Then Pharaoh remembered his proud boast, "Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice to let Israel go? I know not the Lord, neither will I let Israel go." He humbled himself and went with his counselors and his rulers to Goshen in haste, and bowed before Moses and Aaron, and bid them go and serve their God. Their flocks and herds should go also, as they had requested. They implored them to be gone, fearing that if they continued longer, they would be all as dead men. Pharaoh also entreated Moses to bless him, thinking at the time that a blessing from the servant of God would protect him from the further effects of the dreadful plague. Spiritual Gifts, Volume 3, page 246. Verse 38. Many Egyptians acknowledged God. There were quite a large number of the Egyptians who were led to acknowledge by the manifestations of the signs and wonders shown in Egypt that the God of Hebrews was the only true God. They entreated to be permitted to come to the houses of the Israelites with their families upon that fearful night when the angel of God should slay the firstborn of the Egyptians. They were convinced that their gods whom they had worshipped were without knowledge and had no power to save or to destroy. and they pledged themselves to henceforth choose the God of Israel as their God. They decided to leave Egypt and go with the children of Israel to worship their God. The Israelites welcomed the believing Egyptians in their houses, to their houses. Spiritual Gifts, Volume 3, pages 224 and 225. Chapter 14, verses 15, 16, 21, and 22. The hand of Christ rolled back waters. The mighty hand of Christ rolled back the waters of the Red Sea so that they stood up like a wall. Thus he made a dry passage through the sea, and Israel passed over dry shod. Manuscript 155, 1899. Verse 23 and 26 to 28. Pursuit of Israel closed Egyptians' probation. When the whole army, all Israel's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen, were in the very bed of the sea, the Lord said unto Moses, "Stretch out thy rod over the sea." Israel had passed over on dry land, but they heard the shouting of the armies in pursuit. As Moses stretched out his rod over the sea, the embanked waters that had stood as a great wall moved on in their natural course. Of all the men of Egypt in that vast army, not one escaped. All perished in their determination to have their own way and to refuse God's way. That occasion was the end of their probation. Manuscript 35, 1906. Verses 25 to 27. Pharaoh perished in the Red Sea. The monarch hardened his heart and went on from one step to another of unbelief until through the vast realm of Egypt the firstborn, the pride of every household, had been laid low. And after this he hurried with his army after Israel. He sought to bring back a people delivered by the arm of omnipotence. He was fighting against a power greater than any human power. And with his host he perished in the waters of the Red Sea. Manuscript 126, 1901. Chapter 15, verses 23 to 25. A balm for every wound. When Moses presented before the Lord the sad difficulties of the children of Israel, he did not present some new remedy, but called their attention to that which was at hand. For there was a bush or shrub which he had created that was to be cast into the water to make the fountain sweet and pure. When this was done, the suffering people could drink of the water with safety and pleasure. God has provided a balm for every wound. There is a balm in Gilead. There is a physician there. Letter 65A, 1894. Chapter 16, verse 3. Effects of appetite in Israel's experience. Whenever their appetite was restricted, the Israelites were dissatisfied and murmured and complained against Moses and Aaron and against God. But God was proving his people. In order to develop what was in their hearts, he allowed them to pass through severe trials. When they failed, he brought them around to the same point again, trying them a little more closely and severely. In Egypt, their taste had become perverted. God designed to restore their appetite to a pure, healthy state in order that they might enjoy the simple fruits that were given to Adam and Eve in Eden. He was about to establish them in a second Eden, a goodly land, where they might enjoy the fruits and grains that he would provide for them. He purposed to remove the feverish diet upon which they had subsisted in Egypt, for he wished them to be in perfect health and soundness when they entered the goodly land to which he was leading them, so that the surrounding heathen nations might be constrained to glorify the God of Israel, the God who had done so wonderful a work for his people. Unless the people who acknowledged him as the God of heaven were in perfect soundness of health, his name could not be glorified. If the Israelites had submitted to God's requirements, they would have had a healthy posterity, but they chose to follow their own way, walking after the imagination of their own hearts. They gratified their appetites and consulted their own tastes and wishes. As a result, the wilderness was strewn with their dead bodies. Of all the vast multitude that left Egypt, 600,000 mighty men of war, besides women and children, only two entered the promised land. Manuscript 69, 1912. Verse 10, cost of disobedience. If all the teachings given by Christ when enshrouded in the pillar of cloud had been obeyed, the Jewish nation would have stood forth to glorify God above every nation and people upon the face of the earth. Jerusalem need not have been destroyed, but she disregarded the commandments of God while professedly regarding them. Letter 195, 1899. Verses 14 and 15. Wilderness diet made Israel more manageable. If the Israelites had been given the diet to which they had been accustomed while in Egypt, they would have exhibited the unmanageable spirit that the world is exhibiting today. In the diet of men and women in this age, there are included many things that the Lord would not have permitted the children of Israel to eat. The human family, as it is today, is an illustration of what the children of Israel would have been if God had allowed them to eat the food and follow the habits and customs of the Egyptians. Letter 44, 1903, verse 29. Miracle preserved Sabbath. By a miracle, God preserved the Sabbath law through the 40 years of wilderness wandering. Manuscript 77, 1899. Chapter 17, verses 14 to 16. Amalek doomed to destruction. Many years before, God had appointed Amalek to utter destruction. They had lifted up their hands against God and His throne and had taken oath by their gods that Israel should be utterly consumed and that the God of Israel should be brought down so that He would not be able to deliver them out of their hands. Amalek had made derision of the fears of his people and had made sport of God's wonderful works for the deliverance of Israel performed by the hand of Moses before the Egyptians. They had boasted that their wise men and magicians could perform all those wonders, and if the children of Israel had been their captives in their power as they were in Pharaoh's, that the God of Israel himself would not have been able to deliver them out of their hands. They despised Israel and vowed to plague them until there should not be one left. Spiritual Gifts, Volume 4, pages 72 and 73. God did not wish His people to possess anything which belonged to the Amalekites, for His curse rested upon them and their possessions. He designed that they should have an end, and that His people should not receive anything for themselves which He had cursed. He also wished the nations to see the end of that people who had defied Him, and to mark that they were destroyed by the very people they had despised. They were not to destroy them to add to their own possessions, or to get glory to themselves, but to fulfill the word of the Lord spoken in regard to Amalek. Spiritual Gifts, Volume 4, page 75. Chapter 19, verse 3. Ancient instruction to be studied. The instructions given to Moses for ancient Israel with their sharp, rigid outlines are to be studied and obeyed by the people of God today. Letter 259, 1903. Moses and God in secret councils. Moses, the visible leader of the Israelites, was admitted into the secret councils of the Most High. The people were given evidence that Moses did indeed talk with God, receiving from Him the instruction given them. God's covenant, our refuge. The covenant that God made with His people at Sinai is to be our refuge and defense. The Lord said to Moses, "Thus shalt thou say to the house of Jacob and tell the children of Israel, ye have seen what I did unto the Egyptians, and how I bare you on eagle's wings and brought you unto myself. Now therefore, if ye will obey my voice indeed and keep my covenant, then ye shall be a peculiar treasure unto me above all people, for all the earth is mine. And ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and an holy nation." And Moses came and called for the elders of the people and laid before their faces all these words. And all the people answered together and said, "All that the Lord has spoken we will do." This covenant is of just as much force today as it was when the Lord made it with ancient Israel. S.W. March 1, 1904, verses 7 and 8. A pledge to the covenant. This is the pledge that God's people are to make in these last days. Their acceptance with God depends on a faithful fulfillment of the terms of their agreement with Him. God includes in His covenant all who will obey Him. to all who will do justice and judgment, keeping their hand from doing any evil, the promise is, even unto them will I give in mine house and within my walls a place and a name better than of sons and of daughters. I will give them an everlasting name that shall not be cut off. Review and Herald, June 23, 1904. Verse 9. Glory of cloud emanated from Christ. The cloud that guided Israel stood over the tabernacle. The glory of the cloud emanated from Jesus Christ, who from the midst of the glory talked with Moses as he had talked with him from the burning bush. The brightness of God's presence was enshrouded in the darkness of the cloud which he made his pavilion, that the people could endure to look upon the cloud as seeing him who is invisible. This was God's plan whereby he might approach man. Manuscript 126, 1901. Chapter 20, verses 1 to 17. Father by side of Son in giving law. When the law was spoken, the Lord, the Creator of heaven and earth, stood by the side of his Son, enshrouded in the fire and the smoke on the mount. It was not here that the law was first given, but it was proclaimed that the children of Israel, whose ideas had become confused in their association with idolaters in Egypt, that he might be reminded of its terms and understand what constitutes the true worship of Jehovah. Signs of the Times, October 15, 1896. Adam and Eve knew the law. Adam and Eve at their creation had a knowledge of the law of God. It was printed on their hearts, and they understood its claims upon them. Manuscript 99, 1902. The law of God existed before man was created. It was adapted to the condition of holy beings. Even angels were governed by it. After the fall, the principles of righteousness were unchanged. Nothing was taken from the law. Not one of its holy precepts could be improved. And as it has existed from the beginning, so will it continue to exist throughout the ceaseless ages of eternity. Concerning thy testimonies, says the psalmist, I have known of old that thou hast founded them forever. Signs of the Times, April 15, 1886. Law suited to holy order of beings. The Sabbath of the fourth commandment was instituted in Eden. After God had made the world and created man upon the earth, he made the Sabbath for man. After Adam's sin and fall, nothing was taken from the law of God. The principles of the Ten Commandments existed before the fall and were of a character suited to the condition of the holy order of beings. After the fall, the principles of those precepts were not changed, but additional precepts were given to meet man in his fallen state. Spiritual Gifts, Volume 3, page 295. Worded to meet fallen intelligences. The law of Jehovah, dating back to creation, was comprised in the two great principles, Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, and with all thy soul, and with all thy mind, and with all thy strength. This is the first commandment, and the second is like, namely this, Thou shalt love thy neighbors thyself. There is none other commandment greater than these. These two great principles embrace the first four commandments, showing the duty of God to man, and the last six showing the duty of man to his fellow man. The principles were more explicitly stated to man after the fall and worded to meet the case of fallen intelligences. This was necessary in consequence of the minds of men being blinded by transgression. Signs of the Time, April 15, 1875. The law of God existed before the creation of man, or else Adam could not have sinned. After the transgression of Adam, the principles of the law were not changed, but were definitely arranged and expressed to meet man in his fallen condition. Christ, in counsel with his Father, instituted the system of sacrificial offerings, that death, instead of being immediately visited upon the transgressor, should be transferred to a victim, which should prefigure the great and perfect offering of the Son of God. Signs of the Times, March 14, 1878. precepts given to guard Decalogue. In consequence of continued transgression, the moral law was repeated in awful grandeur from Sinai. Christ gave to Moses religious precepts which were to govern everyday life. These statutes were explicitly given to guard the Ten Commandments. They were not shadowy types to pass away with the death of Christ. They were to be binding upon men in every age as long as time should last. These commands were enforced by the power of the moral law, and they clearly and definitely stated that law. Signs of the Times, April 15, 1875. Every specification is God's character. The God of heaven has placed a benediction upon them that keep the commandments of God. Shall we stand as a peculiar people, or shall we trample upon the law of God and say it is not binding? God might just as well have abolished himself. In the law, every specification is the character of the infinite God. Manuscript 12, 1894. Law denounces slightest sin. God has given his law for the regulation of the conduct of nations, of families, and of individuals. There is not one worker of wickedness, though his act be the lightest and most secret, that escapes the denunciation of that law. Manuscript 58, 1897. Holiness made known. Our duty to obey this law is to be the burden of this last message of mercy to the world. God's law is not a new thing. It is not holiness created, but holiness made known. It is a code of principles expressing mercy, goodness, and love. It presents to fallen humanity the character of God and states plainly the whole duty of man. Manuscript 88, 1897. Ten Commandments, Ten Promises. The Ten Commandments, Thou shalt and Thou shalt not, are ten promises assured to us if we render obedience to the law governing the universe. If ye love me, keep my commandments. Here is the sum and substance of the law of God. The terms of salvation for every son and daughter of Adam are here outlined. Manuscript 41, 1896. The ten holy precepts spoken by Christ upon Sinai's Mount were the revelation of the character of God and made known to the world the fact that he had jurisdiction over the whole human heritage. That law of ten precepts of the greatest love that can be presented to man is the voice of God from heaven speaking to the soul in promise, "This do, and you shall not come under the dominion and control of Satan." There is not a negative in that law, although it may appear so. It is "do and live." Letter 89, 1898. A wall of protection. In the Ten Commandments, God has laid down the laws of his kingdom. Any violation of the laws of nature is a violation of the law of God. The Lord has given his holy commandments to be a wall of protection around his created beings, and those who will keep themselves from the defilement of appetite and passion may become partakers of the divine nature. Their perceptions will be clear. They will know how to preserve every faculty and health, so that it may be presented to God in service. The Lord can use them, for they understand the words of the great apostle, "I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that ye present your bodies a living sacrifice, wholly acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service." Manuscript 153, 1899. Verses 3 to 17. Health and obedience to God's law. The law of Jesus in the soul will banish all hatred, selfishness, and envy, for the law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. There is health in obedience to God's law. The affections of the obedient are drawn out after God. Looking unto Jesus, we may encourage and serve one another. The love of Christ is shed abroad in our souls, and there is no dissension and strife among us. Manuscript 152, 1901. No others profess to keep commandments. The ancient Jewish church were the highly favored people of God, brought out of Egypt and acknowledged in his own peculiar treasure. The many and exceeding great and precious promises to them as a people were the hope and confidence of the Jewish church. Herein they trusted and believed their salvation sure. No other people professed to be governed by the commandments of God. Redemption, or the first advent of Christ, page 35. Verse 3. Self-dependence is idolatry. Idolaters are condemned by the Word of God. Their folly consists in trusting to self for salvation, in bowing down to the works of their own hands. God classes as idolatry those who trust in their own wisdom, their own devising, depending for success on their riches and power, striving to strengthen themselves by alliance with men whom the world calls great, but who fail to discern the binding claims of His law. Review and Herald, March 15, 1906. False conceptions of God are idolatry. Are we worshippers of Jehovah or of Baal, of the living God or of idols? No outward shrines may be visible. There may be no image for the eye to rest upon, yet we may be practicing idolatry. It is as easy to make an idol of cherished ideas or objects as to fashion gods of wood or stone. Thousands have a false conception of God and His attributes. They are as verily serving a false god as were the servants of Baal. Review and Herald, December 3, 1908. Satan plants throne between heaven and earth. Satan accomplished the fall of man, and since that time it has been his work to efface in man the image of God, and to stamp upon human hearts his own image. Possessing supremacy in guilt, he claims supremacy for himself, and exercises over his subjects the power of royalty. He cannot expel God from his throne, but through the system of idolatry, he plants his own throne between the heaven and the earth, between God and the human worshiper. Review and Herald, October 22, 1895. Second Commandment and Pictures. A few condemn pictures, urging that they are prohibited by the Second Commandment and that everything of this kind should be destroyed. The Second Commandment prohibits image worship, but God Himself employed pictures and symbols to represent to His prophets lessons which He would have them give to the people, and which could thus be better understood than if given in any other way. He appealed to the understanding through the sense of sight. Prophetic history was presented to Daniel and John in symbols, and these were to be represented plainly upon tables that he who read might understand. H.S. 2.11 and 2.12. Sabbath, a test of loyalty. Every man has been placed on trial, as were Adam and Eve in Eden. As the tree of knowledge was placed in the midst of the Garden of Eden, so the Sabbath command is placed in the midst of the Decalogue. In regard to the fruit of the tree of knowledge, the restriction was made, ye shall not eat of it, lest ye die. Genesis 3:3. Of the Sabbath, God said, ye shall not defile it, but keep it holy. As the tree of knowledge was the test of Adam's obedience, so the fourth command is the test that God has given to prove the loyalty of all His people. The experience of Adam is to be a warning to us so long as time shall last. It warns us not to receive any assurance from the mouth of men or of angels that will detract one jot or tittle from the sacred law of Jehovah. Review and Herald, August 30, 1898. False worship is spiritual adultery. All false worship is spiritual adultery. The second precept, which forbids false worship, is also a command to worship God and Him only serve. The Lord is a jealous God. He will not be trifled with. He has spoken concerning the manner in which He should be worshipped. He has a hatred of idolatry, for its influence is corrupting. It debases the mind and leads to sensuality and all kinds of sin. Manuscript 126, 1901. Flippant speech may be false witness. Slander covers more ground than we suppose. The command, "Thou shalt not bear false witness," means very much more than we realize. False witness is born again and again in flippant speech concerning even the workers whom God has sent. The seeds of envy, of evil thinking and evil speaking, germinate and produce a harvest of their kind to be garnered by the one who planted the seed. Whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. Letter 9, 1892. Chapter 21, verses 1 to 6. Care of the interests of servants. The Lord desired to guard the interests of servants. He commanded the Israelites to be merciful and to bear in mind that they themselves had been servants. They were directed to be mindful of the rights of their servants. In no case were they to abuse them. In dealing with them, they were not to be exacting as the Egyptian taskmasters had been with them. They were to exercise tenderness and compassion in the treatment of their servants. God desired them to put themselves in the place of the servants and deal with them as they would wish others to deal with them under the same circumstances. Because of poverty, some were sold into bondage by their parents. Others who were sentenced for crimes by the judges were sold into bondage. The Lord specified that even these were not to be held as bondservants for more than 7 years. At the end of this time, every servant was given his freedom, or if he chose, he was allowed to remain with his master. Thus God guarded the interests of the lowly and the oppressed. Thus he enjoined a noble spirit of generosity and encouraged all to cultivate a love for liberty because the Lord had made them free. Anyone who refused liberty when it was his privilege to have it was marked. This was not a badge of honor to him, but a mark of disgrace. Thus God encouraged the cultivation of a high and noble spirit rather than a spirit of bondage and slavery. God desires Christians to respect the liberty that he has in so marvelous a manner given them. In Christ is vested the ownership of every man. Man should not be another man's property. God has bought mankind. One man's mind, one man's power should not rule and control another's conscience. In the sight of God, wealth and position do not exalt one man above another. Men are free to choose the service of God, to love the Lord, and to keep all His commandments. Manuscript 126, 1901. Chapter 23, verse 16. Christ's sacrifice provides bounties. The rivers of blood that flowed at the harvest thanksgiving when the sacrifices were offered in such large numbers were means to teach a great truth. For even the productions of the earth, the bounties provided for man's sustenance, we are indebted to the offering of Christ upon the cross of Calvary. God teaches us that all we receive from Him is the gift of redeeming love. Review and Herald, November 10, 1896. Chapter 24, verses 4 to 8. Ratification of the Covenant. Preparation was now made for the ratification of the covenant according to God's directions. Here the people received the conditions of the covenant. They made a solemn covenant with God, typifying the covenant made between God and every believer in Jesus Christ. The conditions were plainly laid before the people. They were not left to misunderstand them. When they were requested to decide whether they would agree to all the conditions given, they unanimously consented to obey every obligation. They had already consented to obey God's commandments. The principles of the law were now particularized that they might know how much was involved in covenanting to obey the law, and they accepted the specifically defined particulars of the law. If the Israelites had obeyed God's requirements, they would have been practical Christians. They would have been happy, for they would have been keeping God's ways and not following the inclinations of their own natural hearts. Moses did not leave them to misconstrue the words of the Lord or to misapply His requirements. He wrote all the words of the Lord in a book that they might be referred to afterward. In the Mount, He had written them as Christ Himself dictated them. Bravely did the Israelites speak the words promising obedience to the Lord. After hearing His covenant read in the audience of the people, they said, "All that the Lord has said will we do and be obedient." Then the people were set apart and sealed to God. A sacrifice was offered to the Lord. A portion of the blood of the sacrifice was sprinkled upon the altar. This signified that the people had consecrated themselves, body, mind, and soul, to God. A portion was sprinkled upon the people. This signified that through the sprinkled blood of Christ, God graciously accepted them as His special treasure. Thus the Israelites entered into a solemn covenant with God. Manuscript 126, 1901. Chapter 25, verses 17 to 22. living angels beside heavenly sanctuary. The ark of the earthly sanctuary was the pattern of the true ark in heaven. There beside the heavenly ark stand living angels, each with one wing overshadowing the mercy seat and stretching forth on high, while the other wings are folded over their forms in tokens of reverence and humility. Chapter 26, verse 31. Temple veil renewed yearly. At the moment in which Christ died, there were priests ministering in the temple before the veil which separated the holy from the most holy place. Suddenly they felt the earth tremble beneath them, and the veil of the temple, a strong, rich drapery that had been renewed yearly, was rent in twain from top to bottom by the same bloodless hand that wrote the words of doom upon the walls of Belshazzar's palace. Spirit of Prophecy, Volume 3, pages 166 and 167. Chapter 27, verse 1. Service of altar restored. Directions were given for building an altar for the offering of sacrifices, a service which had been almost wholly discontinued. While in Egyptian bondage, the people's ideas of sacrifice had been largely molded by the ideas of the Egyptians, who had themselves learned from Israel when they first went into Egypt, but who had mingled with truth the falsehood of idolatry. They had most indecent practices in connection with the worship of their heathen altars. The law given in Eden and repeated on Sinai was essential for the Israel of God, for during the bondage in Egypt, the claims of God in His commandments had been lost sight of. This is why the Lord uttered His holy law with an audible voice in the hearing of all the people. He desired that they should hear His commandments and obey them. Manuscript 58, 1900. Chapter 31, verses 1 to 6. Meddling punished with death. The Lord loves to see His work done as perfectly as possible. In the wilderness, the Israelites had to learn to accomplish with exactness and promptness the work connected with the order of the camp, and especially the work of the tabernacle, its ornaments, and its service. All had to learn before they could accomplish this, to them, new work. They had to be trained before they could do it as God desired. There were men there ready to give counsel and advice and to meddle with the work of mounting and dismounting the tabernacle, and those who neglected their special work to meddle with the work of others, thinking they had special wisdom and knew how it should be done, were put to death. Each one had to be taught the value of promptness and exactness in every position of trust. The memory had to be taxed, and they had to realize the responsibility of doing everything in due time. This is the discipline which the Lord anciently gave to His people, and it is the discipline which should exist in our missions, our colleges, our publishing houses, our sanitariums. God likes to see men understand their weak points, and instead of closing their eyes to their defects, they should make persevering efforts to overcome them. Manuscript 24, 1887. How could the work be done? Israel had been held all their days in the bondage of Egypt, and although there were ingenious men among them, they had not been instructed in the curious arts which were called for in the building of the tabernacle. They knew how to make bricks, but they did not understand how to work in gold and silver. How was the work to be done? Who was sufficient for these things? These were questions that troubled the mind of Moses. Then God Himself explained how the work was to be accomplished. He signified by name the persons He desired to do a certain work. Bezalel was to be the architect. This man belonged to the tribe of Judah, a tribe that God delighted to honor. Manuscript 29, 1908, verses 2 to 7, did not depend on skilled Egyptians. In ancient times, the Lord instructed Moses to build him a sanctuary. The people were to provide the material, and skillful men must be found to handle the precious material. Among the multitude were Egyptians who had acted as overseers for such work and thoroughly understood how it should be done. But the work was not dependent upon them. The Lord united with human agencies, giving them wisdom to work skillfully. Exodus 31, 2-7. Let the workman in the service of God today pray to him for wisdom and keen foresight, that they may do their work perfectly. Manuscript 52, 1903. Verse 13, Sabbath kept during construction. God directed that a tabernacle should be built where the Israelites, during their wilderness journeying, could worship him. Orders from heaven were given that this tabernacle should be built without delay. Because of the sacredness of the work and the need for haste, some argued that the work of the tabernacle should be carried forward on the Sabbath, as well as on the other days of the week. Christ heard these suggestions and saw that the people were in great danger of being ensnared by concluding that they would be justified in working on the Sabbath, that the tabernacle might be completed as quickly as possible. The word came to them, "Verily my Sabbath ye shall keep." Though the work on the tabernacle must be carried forward with expedition, the Sabbath must not be employed as a working day. Even the work on the Lord's house must give way to the sacred observance of the Lord's rest day. Thus jealous is God for the honor of His memorial of creation. Review and Herald, October 28, 1902. Verse 18, Original Law in Heavenly Ark. I warn you, do not place your influence against God's commandments. That law is just as Jehovah wrote it in the temple of heaven. Man may trample upon its copy here below, but the original is kept in the ark of God in heaven, and on the cover of this ark, right above that law, is the mercy seat. Jesus stands there before that ark to mediate for man. Manuscript 6A, 1886. Law preserved in the ark. And he, Christ, gave unto Moses, when he had made an end of communicating with him upon Mount Sinai, two tables of testimony, tables of stone, written by the finger of God. Nothing written on those tables could be blotted out. The precious record of the law was placed in the ark of the testament and is still there, safely hidden from the human family. But in God's appointed time, he will bring forth these tables of stone to be a testimony to all the world against the disregard of his commandments and against the idolatrous worship of a counterfeit Sabbath. Manuscript 122-190. There are abundant evidences of the immutability of God's law. It was written with the finger of God, never to be obliterated, never to be destroyed. The tables of stone are hidden by God to be produced in the great judgment day, just as he wrote them. Review and Herald, March 26, 1908. When the judgment shall sit, and the book shall be opened, and every man shall be judged according to the things written in the books, then the tables of stone, hidden by God until that day, will be presented before the world as the standard of righteousness. Then men and women will see that the prerequisite of their salvation is obedience to the perfect law of God. None will find excuse for sin. By the righteous principles of that law, men will receive their sentence of life or of death. Review and Herald, January 28, 1909. Chapter 32, verses 1 and 2. Aaron's sin pacifying. We repeat, the sin of Aaron pacifying, when the eyesight should be clear to discern evil and state it plainly, even if it places us in an unpleasant position, because our motives may be misapprehended. We must not suffer wrong upon a brother or any soul with whom we are connected. This neglect to stand up firmly for truth was a sin of Aaron. Had he spoken the truth plainly, that golden calf would never have been made. The same spirit that led him to shun to declare the whole truth for fear of offending led him to act a falsehood in pointing to the golden calf as a representative of the one who brought them from Egypt. Thus one unfaithfulness leads to another. Letter 10, 1896. Verses 4 and 5. Idol proclaim God. The result of their murmuring and unbelief was that Aaron made them a golden calf to represent God. He proclaimed this idol to be God, and a great deal of enthusiasm was created over this false god. Review and Herald, September 6, 1906. Tables of law purposely broken. In utter discouragement and wrath because of their great sin, he, Moses, threw down the tables of stone by divine direction, purposely to break them in the sight of the people, and thus signify that they had broken the covenant so recently made with God. Signs of the Times, May 20, 1880. Chapter 34, verse 28. No pangs of hunger. Moses had, on special occasions, been thus long, 40 days, without food, but he felt no pangs of hunger. He was not harassed and tormented by a vile yet powerful foe. Moses was elevated above the human and was enshrouded in the glory of God and was especially sustained of God. The excellent glory enclosed him. Redemption or the First Advent of Christ, pages 47-48. Verse 29, Christ is the glory of the law. The glory that shone on the face of Moses was a reflection of the righteousness of Christ in the law. The law itself would have no glory, only that in it Christ is embodied. It has no power to save. It is lusterless only as in it Christ is represented as full of righteousness and truth. Review and Herald, April 22, 1902. Verses 29 to 33. Moses saw the day of Christ. In the mount, when the law was given to Moses, the coming one was shown to him also. He saw Christ's work and his mission on earth when the Son of God should take upon himself humanity and become a teacher and a guide to the world, and at last give himself a ransom for their sins. When the perfect offering should be made for the sins of men, the sacrificial offerings typifying the work of the Messiah were to cease. With the advent of Christ, the veil of uncertainty was to be lifted and a flood of light shed upon the darkened understanding of his people. As Moses saw the day of Christ and the new and living way of salvation that was to be opened through his blood, he was captivated and entranced. The praise of God was in his heart, and the divine glory that attended the giving of the law was so strikingly revealed in his countenance when he came down from the mount to walk with Israel that the brightness was painful. Because of their transgressions, the people were unable to look upon his face, and he wore a veil that he might not terrify them. Had the Israelites discerned the gospel light that was open to Moses, had they been able by faith to look steadfastly to the end of that which was abolished, they could have endured the light which was reflected upon the countenance of Moses. But their minds were blinded, for until this day remaineth the same veil untaken away in the reading of the Old Testament, which veil is done away in Christ. The Jews as a people did not discern that the Messiah whom they rejected was the angel who guided their fathers in their travels in the wilderness. To this day the veil is upon their hearts, and its darkness hides from them the good news of salvation through the merits of a crucified Redeemer. Signs of the Times, August 25, 1887.